I'm Matt Grenler.
And I'm Dr. Mijan Salitha Bias. And today on K-12 Art Chat, the podcast, we're diving into two episodes of our special series of the Connected Arts Networks, developed in partnership between the National Art Education Association, the Educational Theater Association, the National Association for Music Education, the National Dance Education Organization, and New York City Department of Education's Office of Arts, and funded by a grant from the U.S. Department of Education's Assistance for Arts Education Program. During this set of episodes, our Connected Arts Network's members focus on accessibility and inclusion in the arts classroom.
Let's take a minute to introduce to you one of our friends and co-hosts, and I'm very excited, Dr. Mijan Salitha Bias. Don't worry, Laura's still part of the regular podcast, but I'm super excited to have you with us, Mijan. And I know that our listeners are going to be really excited too, because you have this way of just kind of pulling everybody's stories together. So why don't you just kind of give a little bit about who you are, just so our listeners, in case they're wondering what's going on.
Thank you, Matt. I'm super excited to be here as well. I wear a few hats, all under the umbrella of cultural work and education. I'm an oral historian, culturally responsive educator, and in 2 days, a Fulbright Specialist Awardee. I am designing the curriculum for Universidad de las Artes in Guayaquil, Ecuador. I'm excited. I do want to introduce, though, the guest for this episode. So I'm going to say today's episode is actually a bit unique, because normally Matt is not one of our guests. Matt is a co-host. However, it's a little bit of double duty. We are missing Laura. I'm missing Laura. I mean, I'm sure you are too, because that's your wife. Like, that'd be super awkward if you weren't.
Maybe, no.
However, we get this really wonderful, unique opportunity to have Matt as one of our guests answering the questions instead of just asking them. So let's roll into our discussion. I'm happy to introduce Chrissy Davis, grade 9 through 12 high school orchestra director from Atlanta, Georgia, and Matt Grenler, 6th to 8th grade middle school art teacher from Plano, Texas. Am I pronouncing Plano correctly?
You are, yes, Plano, Texas.
Yes. Welcome to the podcast, Chrissy, then Matt. Would you each take a minute to tell us your teacher origin story? Like, how did you start?
So, like I said, yes, I am the orchestra director at Midtown High School, right in the heart of Atlanta, Georgia. Right across from Piedmont Park is like kind of like the Central Park of Atlanta down here. So this is my 19th year teaching orchestra and guitar. Violin is my main instrument. I started way back in third grade with an awesome orchestra teacher, Renita Humphrey, in Atlanta Public Schools. So I'm also teaching in the school system that I matriculated through, which I think is really cool and really, really awesome. So went through the orchestra programs through Atlanta Public Schools, and got through a lot of teachers that just really, really influenced me, and made me want to follow in their footsteps, to the point where it's like, I'm going to be a music teacher, I am going to be an orchestra director. So I went to Georgia State for my undergrad, and UGA for my master's degree. Started off in Clayton County, which is a little bit south of Atlanta, teaching middle school orchestra. I also founded the Fine Arts Magnet Orchestra down there as well. And then that led me to Atlanta, where I am right now. I am also a doctoral candidate at Georgia State, back at Georgia State for a final time. finishing up, I'm currently on chapter 4 of my dissertation, which is centered around culturally responsive teaching in orchestra classrooms, because I do believe that is really, really important as we kind of, we're evolving the traditional ensemble programs for the future, and recognizing that our student body is diversifying and the traditional methods of teaching are not going to work in the future. So that's what kind of my dissertation centers around. And then in my spare time, if I do have
Do you
spare
have
time.
spare time?
I do not have spare time. I am the Georgia Music Educators Association Orchestra Division Chair. So I think it's pretty safe to say that I eat, sleep, and breathe orchestra.
Clearly. Oh my God. Thank you.
Wow.
That's a lot. Yes. And all super beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing time with us tonight. I want to know also, Matt. I mean, gosh, all this time, over a year now.
You would think, right? You would
Yes.
have think you would have heard it by now,
N
but
and I haven't. What is your origin story? How'd you get here?
My name is Matt Grundler, and I am a middle school art teacher in Plano, Texas. I am in year 20 of teaching art education. And no, not all of it has been not all of it has been at the elementary level. I've kind of jumped around quite a bit, but really my origin story starts with the fact that I grew up in a family of educators. Both my parents were teachers, high school science teacher, as well as elementary general classroom. And really, I was pretty mediocre all throughout school, B's and C's, but never really figured out why I was struggling so much. But I always had a different thought process as far as how I was thinking or why I was thinking a certain way or how things would start to make sense. And so, for me personally, and I didn't even realize when all throughout high school, all throughout college, even into my first 5 years of teaching, where I was teaching elementary school, and my son came to school with us, and we were seeing that he was struggling as well. And through the process of him being tested, for ADHD, I then realized that I myself, it wasn't just like, oh yeah, no, I have ADHD. No, it was like things started clicking for me. And I think that's what I bring into my classroom. I swore I wasn't going to become a teacher because I saw what my parents were doing and the hours that they were putting in. But the impact I saw that they made as an educator. And while I was in college, I've found my amazing wife, Laura, who was an art educator as well, or at least her goal was to be an art educator. And she and I being married early on, and through that process, we really started to figure out. And like I said, that's when I started kind of pulling what I knew of myself and using that way in my classroom, because I knew I didn't want kids to ever really feel that they were inadequate based on what they were doing. And I know that's really deep all of a sudden, but and I've taught, like I said, I taught almost 15 years of elementary. So that was K through five, almost three sets of fifth graders, which is crazy to think about, from like kindergarten all the way up to fifth grade. And then I taught a little bit during COVID of middle school and actually 9 through 12. And then I've actually landed as a full-time position in at this middle school that I am currently. So
That's incredible. I appreciate both of you sharing, I think, myriad aspects of your background that brought you to now. So I'm wondering, well, before I say I'm wondering, I want you to both know, like, I'm extremely honored that you're being honest and transparent from top to bottom with your personal experiences as well as your professional experiences of what brings you to the present day and what powers you and influences your future movement. That said, I want to dive into the topic of accessibility and inclusion in the arts classroom with specificity. I've learned from our previous CAN teacher leaders that they have a mentor or teacher who they would credit with impacting their choice to become an art teacher. And I'm just wondering, can you share if that's true for you, as well as who this person is, if it is true, and tell us their name. Tell us, who they are, their name. Like, don't forget that part. Matt, yeah, do you have a person who lit the spark?
Not necessarily to become an art teacher. I give credit really to both my parents, just on both spectrums of, the upper level as well as the elementary level. What they did was, my dad was a high school science teacher, so you would think art and science doesn't really go together. A lot of our family road trips were turned into science lessons. My dad was all about geology and earth science and physical things, and was always pointing things out. And I'm like, I don't want to learn that. I don't want to know that. It doesn't really pertain to me. But yet, the philosophy, the idea, I'm now teaching art, but I can use that knowledge that he imparted on me, about science, about, all the different things that I can pull into that. And that's grabbing kids' attention because they may be a science kid, they may be a math kid, they may be, all those things. But my father was also a wrestling coach and had been a teacher as well as wrestling coach, for almost 30 years. And one of the things that he imparted on me, along with many other wrestlers in his room, was it was not about how skilled you were. It was the amount of effort you're willing to put into it. And I use that on a regular basis. That is every day. And I even start out my semester, my school year, telling students that when they come in, I said, I don't grade you on skill. I can teach you skill. That's not what I'm worried about. I want you to be willing to put in the effort, because it being an artist of some sort takes practice. And really, it's the amount of effort you're willing to put into it. But also going back to my mom was very much of the idea where you are doing all the multi-sensory things, where you were, using shaving cream to write your name or write letters or learn how to, the phonics. Like, I think about phonics and I think about my mom, because my mom was elementary. She did the K through 2 or 3. She never really went up any higher than that, but she was all about bringing that stuff in to help with the learning. And so, yeah, it was like my parents were kind of on the cutting edge, because now we've kind of come back to that where we're hitting all of these multi-sensory things. So anyway, who are they? Well, Frank Grundler was my dad and Adele Grundler my mom. So
I wish people could see me because I'm smiling so big. I love that. It's your parents, both of your parents. Chrissy, is there one or two teachers who just they lit the spark for you on your path?
there are actually three.
I know. How did I know that you? I mean, I'm like, you are the extra credit person.
Right. There are actually three. I already mentioned Miss Humphrey, the person who put the violin in my hand at age 7, in 3rd grade. If you really think about it, I would not be here right now speaking with you guys if she had not put that violin in my hand in 1999. So yes, Renita Humphrey, my elementary orchestra teacher. Then my high school orchestra teacher, Dolores Major, she was the one that sat me down, noticed my potential. But if you're aware of like the dynamic of the string orchestra program, you have your first and second violins, and you know that hierarchy dynamic of first versus second violins. And I was very comfortable in the second violin section in the middle, being a section player. And she sat me down and she told me, "You need to go woodshed and you need to practice because you are better than this."
Oh,
Noted.
okay.
Noted. Noted. Yes. So she pushed me, and she had what was so great about Miss Major, and in that antidote, she knew when to nurture me, and when to be that kick in the pants that we all needed in the orchestra, which is, I think, a teacher instinct. That's not something that you learn in your teacher pedagogy
It's a
classes.
gift.
It's a gift. It's a gift, knowing when to nurture and when to lay on the tough love. And then my the third person is Natalie Colbert. She was my youth orchestra director, who I saw once a week, but just so influenced. I saw her once a week, but she stuck with me that much that that was the yes, I want to be like Miss Colbert. And all three of those teachers were in APS. And the thing about that is they're all three of them are African American. And so throughout my orchestral development in school, I saw myself reflected in them, which is not the case for a lot of Black and Latino orchestra students, which is why I'm here, sitting right here today. I also had the chance to student teach under Mrs. Colbert, so I got to learn those ins and outs of how to teach. She's amazing, an amazing teacher. Consider it like a goat in the Georgia orchestra world, in national orchestra world. So those teachers helped my development through where I am today, and I can still I call them colleagues. Miss Humphrey is still teaching in a neighboring county. Miss Colbert is retired, but she still does clinics here and there. And Miss Majors, she's a jazz violinist, and she plays around town. So it's interesting that I now call them colleagues, but I still that respect is always still there. They're still Mrs. Colbert, they're still Miss Major, they're still Miss Humphrey. Even they're not. I can never. If it makes sense, I have to show them that respect by not calling them by their first names.
I understand that. I lived in the South 4 years, and that was crystal clear. Crystal clear. I have to wonder about the heart of what both of you just shared in terms of this lineage of art educators who inspired you, and then who you stepped into, or I should say, and then where you stepped into that lineage, that timeline. And so, my question. Especially Chrissy, you said something about I understand culturally responsive education. I'm wondering though if you can help me and also our listeners differentiate and understand if the classrooms and the learning environments that both of you were talking about were special because they understood how to be inclusive and or if there's something that is different, especially Chrissy, if you can talk to how that might be different in terms of culturally responsive pedagogy and education. Chrissy, can you start first by responding to that question and then we'll kick it to Matt?
So just to restate the question, how does culturally responsive teaching or pedagogy, depending on the acronyms that you use, how does that encourage the inclusive environment that we advocate for now?
Yes, for our learners and also for our educators. I think that's important to speak to as well.
So a couple of the main tenets of culturally responsive teaching is number one, recognizing students' backgrounds. And by background, that might be ethnicity, that might be race, that might be sexual orientation, just recognizing who they are as a whole person. Because you want to make sure you establish those relationships and get to the heart of the child who you're trying to impart knowledge in. A part of that is also acknowledging their prior knowledge, what they know before they have entered into your classroom. So acknowledging them as a whole person and their experiences that they bring into the classroom, and help build those relationships can definitely start that inclusion, or the building of an inclusive classroom.
Okay, so then I want to piggyback on that and ask, how do you create an inclusive and supportive classroom community for all learners, even those, especially those who might need differentiation due to physical or cognitive needs?
So, I mean, those first weeks of school, before we even put instruments in, or before we even talk about a piece of music, taking, like I said, taking the time to get to know them and how they identify and their individual needs. I do that formally at the beginning of the year. There's a little Google form that I have them fill out, and they can literally tell me everything that they need to, that I need to know about them. And that can be from stuff, the types of things that I get on the Google form. I learn best by, I'm a visual learner. You know, they'll tell me things like that. They'll tell me their preferred pronouns, if they need to tell me their preferred pronouns, if it differs from the, if you want to call it the government record keeping, if that makes sense. They'll tell me, you know, they'll share with me how they learn best. And then little side conversations, just making sure I'm making sure my classroom is, I try to make it feel like it's their second home here at within the high school. So you have your, where you can eat lunch here if you want to in the orchestra room. You can, if you need just like a few minutes on your own of quiet time in between tests, you can pop in, hey, Ms. Davis, I need a little break to myself. I understand all of that. I wholeheartedly believe, like, if we are going to teach the students, or if the students are going, we're going to reach our students, we do have to take the time to just get to know them as a person outside of the content area that we're trying to impart in them.
Got it. That makes sense. Thank you. I feel clear. Matt, what about you?
I mean, pretty much a lot of what Chrissy was just saying, where you're really getting to know your students, I think that, you know, is really a valuable tool, because it helps build the relationship with the kids. And there are a lot of things where you can overhear, you know, whether it's they are feeling comfortable enough to talk with a neighbor, where you can overhear things and just kind of be able to pick up on those little subtle cues and be like, oh, okay, they have this particular preference as far as what they like or don't like. You know, but being able to sit down and being an art educator, you do have the really nice flexibility to be able to sit down and work alongside them. Work alongside your students. And that's where you start really building those really solid relationships. And I think as far as culturally goes, you know, the more you're knowing about your students, not saying that you have to go out and specifically find things, but just keeping above what, or keeping ahead of, you know, of what is contemporary. You know, I talked about this on the podcast a long time ago, but I had some students, who were writing, in other languages, and, you know, because part of the thing was we were creating a piece of art based off of, letter forms. And some kids were like, oh, can I write this in Arabic, or can I write this in, you know, some another language? And I'm like, absolutely. And they kind of left it at like a certain surface level. And I happened to come across an artist, or I was suggested an artist, and I shared it with my students who happened to be culturally the same as these two students. And all of a sudden these kids were like, wait, you mean I know exactly what that says because I can read it. And they're like, wait, you can work in this huge, massive mural size that almost took up an entire building. Like that's how big this thing was. And it not saying that you're trying to win over anybody, but you're definitely showing them a more contemporary than what is out there. And then as far as the cognitive needs, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I myself, late diagnosis to ADHD and what it is, because it is on a very broad spectrum. And I know that is a disability, or at least I know and understand that more now, because also my son was diagnosed with it. And so use those things as, or at least what I do is I start using them as general teaching practices, not just saying, oh, I'm going to teach this way just for this one kid. I'm going to teach this way for all my kids. So I'm going to break up stuff. I'm going to, you know, break it down into smaller chunks. I'm going to do this or do that and give them that opportunity where I'm not just standing there talking for, you know, 15 to 20 minutes because they're going to totally just tune out. And just being a little bit more understanding helps with that, especially when you're going through it yourself. And I've actually had a parent tell me the first week of open house, they were like, oh my gosh, my child says that you're her favorite teacher because the first things you talked about was the fact that you had ADHD and that it's a struggle and that it's, you know, and that it's something you have to really work through. And she's like, it just made her feel so much more comfortable. And, you know, that makes me feel good. And the fact that they see that this, my students see that I struggle with it, but they also know that there are some strengths that come from it as well. So I think that, I hope that answers the question.
It does. And I feel like it segues perfectly into the next question. Thank you. I mean, it's very clear to me that you're both passionate about inclusion and accessibility. And so I'm just wondering if there's something you can recall in your teaching or personal education that was an aha moment, you know, a moment when you said, I've got to dig into inclusion and accessibility to learn more so that I can be, I think the rest of the question begs, a really great, meaningful educator who connects with their learners in meaningful ways. So I'm wondering, Chrissy, have you had an aha moment? Or, I mean, I'm sure there have been several, but like one that really stands out.
Not necessarily an aha moment, but through the years, you know, students who have been in my classroom who needed accommodations, and who needed accommodations or have been on the spectrum. And it's interesting coming from a traditional ensemble background where, you know, skill is important and, you know, three octave scales and vibrato and playing the Tchaikovsky and da 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 this and da 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 that. But those students would come in, and there's the other side to music that we all have to understand. It's self-expression at the end of the day. It's you know, art. And making sure my students at the end of the day are able to express themselves through music. And like I said, the students that I've encountered along the way have really helped me to see that sometimes it's not about the Tchaikovsky, or it's not about the three octave scale, or it's not about the Allstate audition. So I would say it's my students along the way that's changed my perspective. Because when you get a student and you get the reports from the other teachers that, if we can just be candid, you know, they're difficult to work with, or this, that, and the other, or other negative connotations. But I'm sitting in the same IEP meeting. I'm like, are we talking about the same person? This person, they're learning, they're doing, they're trying, they're making effort. We as teachers have to make the effort to cater to their learning styles, to break it down as needed, to model so they see what needs to be done or how it needs to be done so they can do what they need to do for, in my instance, to express themselves through music. So that would be the big thing, the IEP meetings where I'm like, we're not talking about the same child.
Mm-hmm. Matt, I'm wondering, curious, yeah, if you've had a big aha or medium-sized aha moment.
I mean, yeah, I think it has been along the way. I know that, you know, Chrissy, what you were just mentioning, sitting in some of those meetings, or when I was teaching elementary school, I always knew that one, you know, that one really difficult kid, in the fact that I knew all the other teachers were really struggling with him. So I would make a point that when that class got back to their classroom, I would say to the teacher, hey, look at, I took a picture of it and was like, hey, look at what this kid did today. And they were like, the teachers were just, I mean, every time we're just so, oh my gosh, that I'm like, yeah. Said that I, they're like, he wasn't a problem. I'm like, no, wasn't a problem. Or yeah, they probably were a little bit, but I think a lot of times though, I think what I look back on is the amount of modeling I had for responsibility as well as community. When we were talking, one of the other teachers, I think I may have left out, was my fifth grade teacher. His name was Andrew Bombeck, and his mom was the author Irma Bombeck. And he had, the way he ran his classroom, he actually had a pet. It was a pet snake. And I can say that since Laura's not here, but he had a pet snake that he actually allowed students to come in during lunchtime to be able to hold and kind of take care of, in a sense, you know, and developing a community, developing responsibility. And then also, you know, as I mentioned earlier, my dad being a, not only a high school science teacher, but also being a coach, teaching you about that responsibility, taking care of you, taking care of your stuff, taking care of your team, and having that modeled a lot. And then also, you know, through our K-12 R chat, those things have really solidified. And not necessarily was a big aha that completely turned everything on its side, but it was definitely something that was continually reminded to me of how important community is and how important that responsibility is for you.
I mean, well, so to that end, I'm curious how being a member of a PLC supports you in this work, if, or how, or can a PLC be a place to learn and share about how to meet the needs of all students, a place to brainstorm accommodations or modifications. And if so, how can you do this without violating their privacy? Let's actually, Matt, why don't you, I mean, since you were just, you keep segueing into the question, go ahead first, please.
I mean, I may as well. I mean, you know, I do know kind of what the order of the script, but, but I do also know that, you know, what I will say that what I have learned from my PLC of K-12, really, I think pushed me to be a better educator, not just at the elementary level, but, you know, all, cause I've been saying this a lot, but I think good teaching practice is good teaching practice, no matter what the level that you're teaching. You know, there's a lot of that still. And I think that one of the best things that I learned was how to, from my PLC, from K-12, was that idea that, you know, you would ask, hey, I'm really struggling with this concept, or I'm really struggling with a way to connect, or, oh my gosh, I just saw this teacher in another state, or sometimes even another country, where they are doing something with the same idea, but they're doing it in a different way. And that sometimes can help you figure out how to help those students with disabilities, whether it's, you know, physical or cognitive, and there are times I've even taken pictures of not the kid necessarily, but just like just over their shoulder. So you don't, you know, you don't have the privacy issue of that, but of their work and what they're capable of. And then that's when you can talk with people and be able to brainstorm and come up with more ideas. And, you know, having a community is so important for our own sanity as educators. So
that one, I feel like let's circle it, underscore, highlight all the,
that could be several episodes, but
right there, Chrissy, I have the same question for you. I'm wondering if, how can a PLC be a place to learn and share about how to meet the needs of all students, a place to brainstorm accommodations or modifications?
Ditto what Matt said, like to the T, because it's literally like I have a student right now in my beginning class that had a physical deformity, that has a physical deformity that keeps her from holding the cello in, like it needs to be held. So with her permission, did not, like Matt said, didn't show any identifying features, you know, just the thumb. It was her thumb. She allowed me to take a picture of her thumb that I shared on the Facebook teacher group, and they gave me ideas. So a couple things with that. Us art teachers, we have a tendency, I call us onesies in the school building. Like we're the only ones in our building teaching our content area. So it's necessary for us to have PLCs, or else we'll get in our bubble and we'll think we're alone and there's no one else dealing what we're dealing with, and that's just simply not the case. So like with your PLCs within your school system, like the CAN networks, and I will even venture out and say social media, like the orchestra teacher Facebook pages that I'm a part of, I get a lot of really, really good ideas on like how to deal with that thumb with my student. And other ideas, and like you said, just respect their privacy and making sure that when you do talk about the student or when you do share a picture, that there are no identifying items to relate to link back to the student.
That I know there's this path that we follow in every episode, and I have this like one common thread that weaves throughout. I already know that I'm going to come back to what both of you just said. So that's just a little foreshadowing. I'm hyped actually, because it makes so much sense. It makes so much sense. You have a classroom community. The art educators have to also have their own communities. That's the only way that I think you'll have any sort of well-being in the practice of what you do throughout your day-to-day professional lives. Okay, I'm going to set that to the side. I'm just so excited to say it at the end. However, you know, we've got this tradition. Matt mm-hmm. knows.
I know.
Chrissy, we've got this tradition on K-12 Art Chat, the podcast, of asking a final question, but we're going to change it up for this year's CAN series. I'm wondering, what is one professional goal you have for this school year? How you plan to achieve it? And what you would say to our listeners about their professional goals for this school year. Matt, could you take a crack at this and respond first? And then Chrissy, yeah, share your thoughts.
I mean, I think my professional goal this year, we have started, or I should say sixth graders have been given the opportunity to take art this year as one of their elective choices, where they haven't in a very long time. And so I have three classes of sixth graders, and that is quite a juggle in itself. And along with the other classes that I have as well. I mean, I think professionally, it's going to sound a little bit like a cop-out, but I think trying to manage that plus the other things is to keep more ahead of scheduling things, of making sure my calendar is right. So I'm not like telling a kid, hey, come in tomorrow, and then end up having to back out at the last minute. And just really, because not only does that help you in the classroom, but it also helps you personally too. So the more I can keep straight, the more or more organized, the better off I think, you know, the stress level won't be as much. So, just really planning on breaking it down to try to not let myself get too overwhelmed with all the things that I have to do, and just be like, okay, I'm going to schedule a certain day. That's going to be my day to plan out for like the next 2 weeks. You know, some people are all about that, and I give them full kudos for being able to plan out like a whole semester, like 9 weeks. Just not me. I just can't. But I think, you know, giving yourself that little chunk of time to say, okay, I'm going to do this every Tuesday, or I'm going to do this every Thursday. I'm going to get caught up on my tracker accommodations, or I'm going to get caught up on my, you know, whatever it is. And then just kind of really slowing that down. And if, you know, if you have a group of people that you can talk to them. So.
Chrissy, same question.
Kind of along the same lines. I would, for me, it's definitely balance. Like Matt, all of the obligations that I have on my plate this year, making sure I'm balancing it, and also making sure my kiddos, I call them my kiddos, are not negatively affected by it. For example, you know, I have long writing nights ahead of me. With my dissertation, I need to make sure that, thank God there's a Starbucks across the street from the school, that I'm not taking my long writing nights out on my kids. Making sure that's the biggest goal, I guess I would say, making sure that my kiddos are not affected by my busy schedule, because when you think about it, they're the reason I'm so busy. I have great students that allow me to, that have helped me show that, you know, get me to the place where I am as orchestra division chair, to where I am working on my dissertation and moving into those leadership roles within the world of orchestra in Georgia. So I definitely want to make sure that they don't get the short end of the stick, basically.
That makes a lot of sense. I feel like I've gotten restored from this conversation, because I mean, just to be transparent about sort of my mood as I was ending one part of the workday and then beginning this part, there was a part of me that was noticing what I was saying, but not 100%, which was, oh man, you know, I'm working through something where I'm trying to complete tasks and all the things before I head off for this Fulbright. And I notice any time that I think that I am alone, and that's the story that I'm telling myself, whether it's accurate or inaccurate, it's going to lead to me feeling really frustrated and defeated and all of that sort of stuff. So then to tune into this conversation and to hear from two art educators, I mean, first off, coffee, I'm like, that always is going to get my vote. And to hear from Matt, I wrote down modeling for responsibility and community. And I just kept writing down every single time Chrissy opened up her mouth and said something, balance and commitment. Like, I kept hearing it over and over and over again from both of you. I feel like you can't go wrong with those things. You can only go right. And it's this reminder that I needed to hear personally in this today moment. All boats rise. When you're leaning out into meaningful community, especially as arts educators who are working in isolation and many times in their, sometimes their district, sometimes the actual school, all boats are going to rise when arts educators have each other in meaningful ways in community. So I think that's the golden set of themes for the conversation today. I could not be more happy or more grateful or more restored by everything that you said, Chrissy and Matt. Thank you. I'm also going to thank our listeners. And the final word that I just have to end on is, I mean, it's not even a word. I'm kind of breaking a rule here, but connect with people. You can't go wrong. You can only go right. Meaningful people, meaningful community. So thank you for joining us in today's conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh my goodness. Jean, I gotta give props to you for this, because you were kind of thrown into this a little bit, and you practically ran the show tonight. So I was very happy. And that was an amazing conversation.
Oh, it was amazing on my end, because it just, for a different reason, flowed. I understand, obviously, you've got sort of the questions ahead of time, and I always am improvising a little bit here and there, so you never know exactly what's coming out of my mouth. However, you just kept, I mean, it's the lovely part about being an interviewer when the interviewee just kicks it into the next mm-hmm. question seamlessly. Oh, yeah. I mm-hmm. love that. I live for that. So thank you.
I tried. I don't know if I really tried, but I tried. I'm just going to say I tried. So, I hope that Chrissy, I hope she's able to survive her writing that she has going on ahead of her. And I gotta give props to that. So that is huge. And I'm hoping that she is able to share some resources of, you know, where she gets some of her inspiration or her communities that she looks out to. So
I am too, especially because she's wearing the hat simultaneously of learner mm-hmm. and educator. So I hope she has all of the communities.
If you don't know, then a really good place to look for our resources or like in the podcast, we will usually share them on davisart.com. And that is actually where you look under free resources, and it will be, you'll find K-12 Art Chat podcast along with all of our episodes and along with our there'll be a resource page with each episode. So that's kind of cool. That way if people miss them and they're like, oh my gosh, what did they say, that they can go back there and look, and just most of them are linked. So all you gotta do is just click it and it takes you right to that resource. You know, we have several ways that people can get a hold of us. They can find us on all of our social medias, Creativity DEPT on Instagram, as well as I think there's K-12 Art Chat Community. It's PLN Community on Facebook, and all the social media platforms. But if they wanted to send us an email or something like that and like give us a suggestion of who we might talk with on our episodes, or you know, what kind of topic they might want us to talk about, they can easily send us an email at thecreativitydept@gmail.com. And we would love for people to be able to share this podcast along with this episode or any other episodes, and just really be able to like them, subscribe them, and also rate it too, because we want to make sure that we're doing things that are keeping people that are, well, I should say we're doing things that are recent and people that want to know what, you know, more contemporary and find out what's going on currently. So, once again, we hope that you all enjoyed this podcast, and wishing you a creative week.